dictionary definition of music is the art of arranging sounds in time through the elements of melody, harmony, rhythm, and timbre. Low-pass filter is a show about the nature of this thing we call music, how it functions in people's lives, how it's contextualized by society, and why we find certain music meaningful. This is Low Pass Filter. Hello, and welcome to Low Pass Filter. This is a show where we talk about music and what it means in our lives. As always, my name is Mateo Noche, and I'm joined by Bandon Wayne.
Good morning.
Have you ever considered a nom de plume?
I have one as a DJ streamer.
Oh, okay.
DJ Nighty.
That's right, yeah. I knew that.
Otherwise, I'm not very good at coming up with cool names. So
right.
It'd probably be better if somebody bequeathed a cool name upon me, I suppose.
Yes.
So if you ever think of one.
I'm going to puzzle that out. Well, as we do every month, we go back and forth on topics. I choose one, Bandon chooses one. In this case, it was my turn to choose one. And this could turn out to be thorny, but what I chose was the Desert Island List. Imagine you or Tom Hanks, you've got Wilson, you're dropped on an island, but you do have some sort of device that can reproduce albums.
Yeah.
And so you get 10 for the duration of your being cast away upon this island.
Before you got stranded, somehow you were able to grab 10 of your favorites.
When the plane was going down, you used your LPs as a flotation device. I'm not sure how well that would work. But let's just say, in the interest of this exercise,
yes,
that would have worked.
Well, putting it on a desert island makes sense because, you know, it's like you have no access to anything else. This is what you're going to grab to last you for however long.
That's right.
And so you're putting it in the framework of, would these 10 albums satisfy me, keep me content, keep me happy indefinitely without wishing that you had picked something else?
I'm sure you would probably grow to resent some of them after a while, but it's just sort of an intellectual exercise.
And I think every musicologist, every music nerd does this. We pontificate on you know, what would our 10 all-time desert island records be?
Right. And, you know, what occurred to me as I was compiling this list was there might be a difference between what you need to survive on a desert island and what your absolute favorite records are. So now, you'll notice I didn't say favorite records of all times. It was, what could you survive with, you know?
Yes. I think I may have favored all-time favorites a little bit heavier, but I was keeping in mind, how long can I listen to this over and over and over again? What about it satisfies me in that way? Because when you're talking about greatest of all time, then you're getting into critical theory about what makes an album great, and
right,
maybe why everyone should consider that a great record. These are more personal favorites, perhaps.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. In my case, they're not the greatest albums of all time. Maybe, well, you know, so subjective. So,
yes,
it's such a personal thing. But they were just something that I thought that I could live with, and I needed to have little representative bits, you know.
Yeah. It was a little puzzling that you'd put the Chipmunks Christmas album on your list. But
well, yeah.
It never gets
Elvin!
Old.
Elvin!
It never gets old.
It never does. It never does it. So I think maybe the way we'll run this show today is we're just going to bounce back and forth.
Okay.
I'll start off with my first one, We'll go to you, and then we see if we can work our way through the list of all 10 in the amount of time that we have.
Sounds good. I don't know about you, but I figure we probably didn't rank them in any order.
Or did you? Yeah. No, I didn't. That would have made it even more difficult. But all right, so I'll just start off throwing my first one, which is the band Yes and their album Close to the Edge.
Oh, God. I saw that on your list. I got the preview, and I would have no argument there.
Yeah.
Did not put it in my list, but that is a monster of an album.
It is. Recorded in 1972. And one of the things I noticed about my list when I got this all done was there's nothing from the 21st century in this.
Not in mine either.
Yeah, I don't know what that means exactly, but anyway, that's the way it ended up. Anyway, this record was recorded in 1972. It was their fifth album. It had a centerpiece, 18-minute track, inspired by Hermann Hesse's novel, Siddhartha. The last record that included Bill Bruford as the drummer. He went on to join King Crimson. Just for me, it's a very meditative record, and I'll often put it on when I'm doing some sort of task, you know, of some sort of creative task, or I'm working on something that I you know, assembling something or doing something.
Interesting.
And you know, I don't know if I think we've talked about this in before when we talked about, you know, what purpose is music. We did do a show about what purpose music serves in your life. And so one of the purposes for this record for me is just really just to kind of propel me, you know, when I'm doing something.
Interesting. That makes me think of some music can function as background soundtrack wallpaper while also being something that draws you in.
Yeah.
And sometimes your mind can sort of allow that to be in the background. Other times it'll start to creep in and your focus shifts, you know, right to the music. But I could see that with that record. I do find that a very engaging record. So if you're in that mood, you know, it's a progressive rock masterpiece.
It is. Yeah.
And
let's see, it's on a bunch of people's lists as one of the top records of all time. Rolling Stone pegged it at 445. I'd quibble with that, but
445
out of 500.
Out of 500.
Yeah.
That's well. It's hard to narrow down five.
Yeah, Guitar World ranked it at 67. Sound and Vision 32 on the top 50 albums of all times.
I've heard other musicians cite that record as a big influence, particularly from the group Yes. Although amongst people who love Yes, there's different picks of the best.
Absolutely.
Fragile,
but of that period, Bill Bruford, Rick Wakeman period.
Yeah. And that was the record that turned me on to Yes.
Yeah.
I hadn't really considered them in the same way that I did King Crimson and even a group like Rush. And one day, just that green album cover just spoke to me. I was like, I need to investigate this. And that was it.
Yeah, the whole Roger Dean too.
Yeah.
Back in when you folks that have vinyl records, you know, where you get out the album cover and look at it and stuff, but there's this there's this kind of imaginative panorama, fantasy sort of panorama that just great art and sort of sets the mood for the whole thing. But
that's a great one. You would you'd be happy to live 10 years on a desert island and continue to listen to
it. If I only got one, I think that might be it.
Really?
Yeah.
So even out of your 10?
It probably is. That's probably, I put it at number one probably for
that's heavy
a reason.
Duty. Yeah. Just like the record.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, these aren't in any particular order. We discussed that. So I'll just start off. The first thing I typed on my list was The Doors' Strange Days.
Great record.
Second album by The Doors.
Yeah.
I love the whole Doors catalog. Probably could have debated picking L.A. Woman. But Strange Days, pound for pound, most most songs on that singular album that I just absolutely adore, and that's my first go-to Doors album if I'm pulling one out of the collection. I'd have to look at the cover, I guess, maybe to Scott.
It's got like a little midget, I think, dancing on it.
Yeah.
A David Lynchian sort of scene.
Yes, it's got the kind of freaks, circus freaks,
yep.
Kind of surrealistic feel about it. But Strange Days, Your Lost Little Girl, Love Me Two Times, right in a row.
Yeah.
And then the side two starts with People Are Strange and ends with the music when the music is over.
Right, right.
So,
yeah.
And I think of the Doors as one of the most important rock bands of all time. So
agreed. Yeah, I know people that don't like them.
Indeed, yeah.
So one person in particular says that Robbie Krieger is the worst guitar player in rock. Which,
wow.
Yeah,
wow,
which was that was a kind of an owie.
That's a specific call out.
Like, yeah,
you got to be so harsh on.
I don't know. I don't agree. In fact, he's really a talented flamenco guitar player. A lot of people don't realize that kind of is a scene that he came out of, which is a very very demanding style of guitar
Indeed.
Playing. But I think it's that hippy-dippy, psychedelic thing that some people react against.
The Doors are interesting because they're really a sum of their parts kind of group.
Yeah.
They're all talented, but they really all serve this feeling that only the Doors had, in my opinion. I think the main beef people have with the Doors is Jim Morrison, for the most part.
The Lizard King.
Yeah, I think what I hear most often, and there's some other groups of that classic rock era, as they say, that people just feel they're oversaturated by. They played on the radio too.
Absolutely,
much.
Yeah. And that's not their fault. You know, that might be another show about things that got overplayed, and I might have some of that on here. But
the phrase I hear the most often that really irks me on a certain level, I mean, I'm not, you know, trying to be mean towards anybody, but the common phrase is, I've heard that so much, I don't ever need to hear it again. Like, for me personally, that goes against the grain of how I am about music that I love, but yeah, you've heard it so much, it's ingrained in your mind, so therefore your ears don't need to hear it again.
Right. I kind of understand that thought. I have like these earwig things that happens. I can basically, there are certain albums I can just replay in my mind without hearing them, out loud. But yeah, not that record. That record is always fresh and always sounds great.
I think also that all of the Doors music, but that one in particular, for some reason to me, signals a lot of the kind of darker alternative sort of post-punk music to come.
Yes.
Big influence on, you know, what we might call art rock, post-punk, gothic music, punk in general, right, you know. So I think it's even been said that the Stooges might not exist without the Doors. You know, Iggy Pop was influenced by Jim Morrison and the Doors. So
yeah,
that's one of the reasons I consider them one of the most important rock bands. I think their influence really spread far and wide. And I like, as another kind of thought exercise, is where would we be or what would we know in popular music if we removed this block from the chain? You know?
Yeah. 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 Good one. Yeah. Well, for my number two, I have the band that Bruford bounced to and the record that he bounced to after Close to the Edge. Yeah. And that's Lark's Tongue and Aspic.
That's good back-to-back picks there. Because, yes, he leaves you with this all-time great album. And then
moves on to one of the all-time great,
possibly the coolest King Crimson record in a way, because it's a transitional record. He comes in, they're not quite at that period that a lot of people refer to as the red period.
Right.
when they become a three-piece, they're still a five-piece band, I think.
Yeah.
On Larkstown.
Well, this was the first record for John Wenton.
Yes.
They had percussionist Jamie Muir and David Cross, who was a keyboard and violin player. This also was released in 1973. It's their fifth record, just like the, Yes's fifth record. But there's just a wealth of great soundscapes and just really rock that just totally slays. And it goes from, it's that kind of whisper to a scream sort of thing.
Yeah.
Dynamics, which you don't get much in today's records. The kids don't really, you know. But it's kind of true that we've kind of come into the era of brick wall limiting, you know, where just really everything, even the loudest and the softest parts of music are all at the same level.
Yeah.
In the analog days, well, they had they had limiting and compression and that sort of thing. It was used in a different way, necessarily because you couldn't do that on an LP groove. Really, it would just be a mess. So, but anyway, one of the things about the record is just really the contrast and the dynamic contrast in it. And lyrically, it's totally terrific.
Yeah. Indeed, and following that record, they become a three-piece, I believe. Just
I think they go down to four, actually.
So is there one before?
Yeah. And then I think on Red, which is basically a three-piece, they do have I think David Cross comes back and does a song or two.
Yeah, there's violin in there. But I guess what I was thinking of is that record kind of stands alone. It's in between these phases or these chapters of King Crimson, I think. But like you were talking about the dynamics on it, it's got beautiful parts. It's got stuff
just like really tender, sweet and tender.
Indeed.
And then there's some slamming sections of it that they're really laying
stuff
it down.
That you wouldn't necessarily call heavy metal, but it's of that level of jarring, intense, distorted guitar. And that was really the first King Crimson record I ever dove into. And contrasting with a lot of stuff I was listening to at that time, it was very mind-expanding, I guess you could say.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's a great pick, man. Well, I'm going to go fairly far away from that and bring up Rebel Yell by Billy Idol.
Okay. All right. it's a great record.
Why do I pick that record?
I'll just mention, I was working at Music Plus when that record came out, and I sold a lot of those.
Yeah, I would imagine. It was huge. He was already big before that, probably with White Wedding and Dancing with Myself on his first record. But the song Rebel Yell was big. And then he had, this is the video age. So
yes.
Videos were selling records at that time as well.
The MTV age.
Aside from the radio. And I would argue that Billy Idol was an early master of the music video format. Or at least the people he worked with conceptually creating these kind of worlds within his videos that serve to, you know, as a vehicle to sell himself, but also create an artistic, sort of mini film for the song.
Mm-hmm.
Especially off of that record, it has kind of a sort of like an Escape from New York dystopian near future kind of quality with some of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, Eyes Without a Face.
Oh yeah.
Flesh for Fantasy, Rebel Yell, and then some other songs like Daytime Drama and Blue Highway and stuff. So, that's a record I could listen to front to back never, I listen to it all the time, as a matter of fact. If not just a song here and there, but I'm always having Billy in rotation. He is one of my all-time favorite pop rock artists or popular music artists. I don't know how to explain it, but I kind of refer to Billy Idol as my spirit animal, just in the sense there's something about his
sort of. He's got a good snarl.
He's got a great snarl. I can't do the snarl. We're not similar, but just the spirit of his vision coming out of the UK original punk scene with Generation X.
Yeah.
Teaming up with Steve Stevens just seemed like such mm-hmm. a great synergistic musical idea.
Yeah.
Steve Stevens to me is kind of between Johnny Thunders and Joe Satriani or something. You know,
yeah.
He's kind of big hair.
Technically great, but not afraid to cut loose and do the gut bucket.
Yeah, and really play to the song.
Guitar solos. Yeah.
Conceptually serve the song along with mm-hmm. Billy Idol's vision. So anyway, Billy Idol's somebody I can continue to love and not feel oversaturated by for some odd reason.
Nice. Well, it's time for us to take a break. We're going to go away for a minute, and then we're going to come back with more low-pass filter. Desert Island picks. We each have 10. We're going to try and blaze through these before we run out of time.
It's so easy to want to just elucidate the qualities of each record.
That's right. Well, we can do that a little bit, but I think we just have to talk faster.
Yeah.
Okay, so my next one is Rock Pile, Seconds of Pleasure.
I know of that, but I've never checked out Rock Pile.
Oh, man.
So that's a new one
to
me.
Well, Rock Pile is kind of an interesting thing. It's an album, it's a band, it's Dave Edmunds, it's,
Okay.
This was the only Rock Pile, official Rock Pile record. They did a lot of the canon, him and Nick Lowe did a lot of the canon, in other configurations as Dave Edmunds records. Brinsley Schwartz was the kind of the forerunner to all this.
Okay.
But just a really great vocal ensemble, Bill Bremner, Terry Williams, they all sang. They very much in the, the Everly Brothers kind of,
okay.
In fact, this kind of had started off as sort of a mini Everly Brothers ode LP or EP that morphed into a full record. But really just close, tight harmonies, really great slamming guitar, that pub rock thing.
Right.
Really upbeat. Teacher was the hit off of that record.
And did you say Nick Lowe is involved in this?
Yeah, Nick Lowe was the bassist, vocalist in this band. But just a fabulous record. And just tuneful, I guess, is
yeah.
My way of describing it.
Yeah. Sounds like your cup of tea.
It is my cup of tea.
That's
right.
That's awesome. I, for years, knew the name Rock Pile. It just didn't relate to me. Nobody exposed me to it. I think maybe their album cover didn't look like something I would necessarily respond
Check
to.
Check it out. I think you'll like it.
I probably would. Yes, indeed. Well, keeping in the 80s alternative pop rock, I guess, Big Country.
Okay, yeah.
So I'm wearing their t-shirt.
I see that.
The debut album by Big Country. Now that's definitely an example of a record that I would not try to convince people is one of the greatest records of all time, mm-hmm. in the pantheon of greatest records. That wouldn't really work critically, but for the era, for where kind of new wave alternative rock was, I think they were a pretty hip band. They were Scottish. They had guitar melodies that kind of emulated the traditional bagpipe kind of melodies. And just front to back, that whole record really works for me. Every song is as quality as the previous song on there. And it just has a super soft spot in my heart. It was a record when I was 16, 17. I played over and over again. I think my parents liked it when I was 10 or 11. I had a fire in my bedroom when I was a teenager. That didn't burn the house down, but that record was on the turntable at the time, and part of it melted down from the heat.
Yikes.
And so I was very eager to acquire that record again at some point. Now I have several copies of it. I have it on 8-track. I have it on cassette tape.
You're not taking any chances.
No. It's just, I mean, finding that on an 8-track at a thrift store, I was like,
wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so it just...
Coincidentally, I sold a few of those when I was at Music Plus.
Wow, yeah. You were working there in the heyday.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Was that inside of a mall?
No, it wasn't. It was a standalone store. Cool. It was kind of the pre-mall record store era.
Yeah. That's cool, man.
Yeah.
So if you never heard that record, and I think we'll post a list of these on maybe...
We'll have to figure that out. We might have to post songs from them because you can't post the entire record. Usually we do a Spotify playlist, but you can't post
right.
the entire album.
I was just
album.
Wondering if we could type it in the description or something like that, but... Cool. That would be for the YouTube viewers.
Yeah.
Anyhow, moving on.
Yeah, moving on. Next one I have is Suburban Lawns.
Another one.
Suburban Lawns. They're the only full-length record they made.
Uh-huh. I again, a record I never listened to, but I know some people that really, really love that.
Yeah. I just can't say enough about the quality of the band and itself. A lot of the focus kind of fell on the oddness, shall we say, of Sue Tissue, the singer, but the guys that played in this band were really, really good musicians, and some of the best 15-second guitar solos you're ever likely to hear in your life. The song that was their breakout song, and I think also ended up on MTV in that era, was the song "Janitor," which was a interesting song, and I think Flying Saucer Safari was also also made it into the MTV era, but it's really the other songs on the record that are all in the under 3 minute range. It's just amazing what they pack into the 2 minutes. It all makes total sense. It all just works, is really super exciting, and if you're not familiar, I'm just gonna, or you out there are not familiar with this record, I'm just gonna suggest that you take a moment to check it out.
I've never come across a vinyl copy of it. It's almost like something that I've almost willfully ignored for some reason. Maybe, you know, sometimes when somebody doesn't expose me to something, and I hear a band name or look at an album cover, I sometimes just go, I don't know if I relate to that. What is it? Suburban Lawns. I think probably the first time I heard that name, like, just the conceptually the name didn't make sense to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get what a suburban lawn would be, but why is somebody named that? I don't know.
Yeah, there's no telling why people name things what they do, but anyway, just a really solid record,
I
highly recommend it.
Well, how can I disrespect a high recommendation from you? I need to check it out. Here's another. I guess I was just typing these in the random order that I had my stack in. Edie Brickell and the New Bohemians, mm-hmm. Shooting Rubber Bands at the Stars.
Right.
Their debut, the very first track on it is a song that I figure most people have probably heard called What I Am.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What I Am is What I Am. Not my favorite song on the record, but as a standalone single cut, I think it's great. I play that song quite a bit, but that's just another one of those personal, emotionally stirring records. I wouldn't argue that they're one of the best bands that ever was, mm-hmm. but they were a good band, a fairly high level of musicianship as an alternative rock band.
And didn't she marry Paul Simon?
She may have.
Yeah, I think she did, actually.
She may have become some sort of a royalty with Paul Simon.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
You don't hear a lot about them. I think early on it was kind of like, oh, Edie Brickell and Paul Simon are a thing.
Yeah.
He's much older.
It's either before or after Carrie Fisher, I don't remember.
Oh, after? Are they still together? I haven't followed
them. Well, he's not together with Carrie Fisher because she's no longer.
I mean Paul.
No, no, Edie. I think they broke that up a while ago.
I mean, he's an aged man at this point.
He is. He's up there. Yeah, yeah.
And that's cool. They hit it off with a musical connection. And
yeah.
She probably, you know, thought he was cool.
Well, this is probably 30 years ago, or I guess 40 years ago. Or time
we're
flies.
Not,
when
we're not in the 90s.
No, we're not.
What happened?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a great record, though.
Yeah, yeah. It just has a unique quality about it. Their next couple, at least, are decent records. Pretty good. Records, and some fans probably love those as much, if not more. I don't know, but again, it's just one of those song after song. It resonates with me, and I can flip it over and over and over again. So
nice.
If you don't know that one, go check it out.
Yeah. Well, the next one I have a record I know we both like. It's called Time Out.
Yes.
By the Dave Brubeck Quartet.
Almost. I considered it for my pile. I let it go. Maybe possibly based on the principle that that song or that record is playing in my head by heart.
Could be. Yeah. Well, of course, the song Take Five was actually one of the first jazz records to break into the top 10. It peaked at number 2 on the Billboard pop charts, not on the jazz charts, but on the pop charts.
Yeah.
But this is a record that's known for its unusual time signatures that they did. Songs at 9/8 and 6/4 and 5/4. And it's just a really swinging record. And it has that kind of upbeat feel to it, that New Frontier era, 60s, late 50s, early 60s, when anything, including nuclear annihilation, seemed possible. But it's just a happy record. And
it is a happy record. There's maybe a little bit of wistful moments on there. But kind of vanguard of the West Coast jazz movement. You could almost say that it has kind of a mod feel to it.
Yeah.
Because even though the bebop scene and a lot of other jazz was pushing boundaries big time, in its own way, it created a whole fresh sound that didn't exist before.
Absolutely.
And we've talked about this in perhaps our first episode, that's one of the earliest records in my life.
Yeah.
One of the first records I've
Yeah, I think
knew.
I also had that as well. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that should have been my Wilson maybe, but but like I said, I just absorbed it so much. That is a great Desert Island record. Any other?
No.
We're blazing through. All right. Well, I got a jazz record. Noel Pointer, Fantasia. We've talked about him before. I don't know if you're familiar with
that really record. I'm just going to have to confess my ignorance.
So he had a short career. I don't know exactly where it began, but this record, interestingly, is on Blue Note,
mm-hmm.
but has the production of Dave Grusin and perhaps could have been a GRP album release. He's playing more with that cast of musicians that came out in 1977. Mm-hmm. He's an African-American man who was a brilliant violinist and basically is doing what you'd hear from Jean-Luc Ponty or other jazz fusion cats of that time. And one of the greatest attributes is having Steve Gadd on drums.
Oh yeah.
In that recording. It's a very electrifying fusion jazz record, but it has very heavy emotional points in it as well. There's a cover of Living for the City by Stevie Wonder that's mm-hmm. brilliant. So it's, you know, if you like Mahavishnu Orchestra, if you like Weather Report, if you like those kind of fusion albums of that era, it's right in there. But it's another one of those ones I was hearing as a child, and it's just been with me my whole life, and I own four vinyl copies of it.
Right on. Well, I'm gonna have to check that out, because I think
you would highly appreciate it.
I have no awareness of that whatsoever. Okay, next up, Elvis Costello, Imperial Bedroom. Yeah,
can't even think of which one that is off the top of my head.
It was his seventh studio album with the Attractions. It was released in 1982. Production by Jeff Emmerich, and placed emphasis on studio experimentation and the use of unusual instruments, including things like harpsichord, accordion, and string arrangements. And it's got that kind of wall of sound feeling to it. But I just think they were so on point with the songwriting. The Attractions, always a dynamite band, always great.
And you said they're seventh?
Seventh.
By 82, he's...
Yep, he'd already made seven records. Yeah. So
the hardest working guy in the business.
Yeah.
Had he moved beyond Stiff Records at that point?
Yeah. It was a major label.
Yeah.
Major label release. And they've re-released a record that has actually more material than the original record, alternate takes of a lot of the songs and songs that didn't make it onto the record, which is highly, highly interesting.
Yeah.
But the original record just hangs together so well as one of those kind of records that you can listen to front to back with that, you know, and it just all flows really together thematically, musically.
I think that's a major point in the records that we've chosen, is that you're not putting that record on and going, well, I can listen to these songs in between the songs I really love. Mm. It's every song feels like it's as good as any other track on there, and so you're thinking, if I were to be stuck for any period of time and only had this record to listen to, it wouldn't get frustrating, because... So if I saw the cover of that, I would probably recognize it, but by the title...
It's kind of an abstract cover.
Well, again, I'm not surprised with your Elvis Costello selection. I picked another jazz fusion record by Billy Cobham.
Okay.
And this one I know you know.
Yeah.
Spectrum.
Oh, yeah.
Billy Cobham. I pulled it out and considered it because of how often I listen to this record. Again, if I was putting in a list of greatest records of all time, it'd be in that list, I think. It's a very formidable record, in my opinion, but I ultimately chose it because I go to it all the time. Billy Cobham's drumming is just...
Dude was a monster. Yeah.
Monster. I think I used this word a moment ago, but electrifying. There's an intensity level on this record that rarely lets up. Occasionally it does. He gives you a little breather. And then back into just funky fusion jazz that is clearly fueled by the drummer driving it. And Billy Cobham is that kind of drummer who does not take a back seat. He is in the driver's seat. And so,
one of the all-time greats,
Definitely. Played with Mahavishnu Orchestra. But it's these recurring moments I have with this record where I will be shaking my head in disbelief at what's going on, and the effort of all the musicians involved just playing these sort of on fire tunes together. So I think time has proven to me that I don't get sick of that record. And it would.
Good one.
Yeah.
All right, well, time flies, and it's time for us to take another break. We'll be back with some more Low Pass Filter right after this. Filter. We're talking our Desert Island top Desert Island tunes. We've picked out 10 our records. We picked out 10 a piece.
It just so happened that we were traveling and had a suitcase of
that's right
10 records, and the plane went down onto an island.
That's
and,
right. That was the only thing that survived.
Yeah, a portable record player, and maybe I had a hand crank on it.
Whatever works.
Yeah.
Whatever
so, works. So yeah. We find ourselves.
Well, you know, my one of my alternate universes is this place called Analog Island, right? And so it's, and I think this would be a great resort. It would be like an island that you go to where none of the technology was created after 1965.
Okay. Wow. Yeah.
So you could have LPs, you could have a radio station, there would be television. But it would be vacuum tubes, essentially. But no smartphones, none of that. You'd have to write letters to people if you wanted to connect somebody. You could send them.
Yeah.
You could drop them a postcard, or something. But anyway, I digress. And we don't have a lot of time for digression.
I was just going to say I would buy a ticket. To,
yeah, yeah.
To Analog.
I mean, I think I do think it would work, because I think there are a lot of people that are just so sick of being tied to their smartphones and having stuff scream at them all day long that it would be kind of a great vacation just to get away from
and
all that.
And there would still be some cool modern stuff.
Yeah.
You
could still enjoy music. You could still enjoy.
Yeah.
You know, they have blenders, so you could still make tropical drinks. You know, so it'd be great.
Oh, man.
Okay, so my next one is a thing called Songs of the Italian Renaissance by an artist called Shirley Rumsey.
Yeah,
I mean, I know. I went through an early music kick where I was very interested in early music. I still love it. I just don't like obsess about it anymore.
Yeah.
But this record is just all atmosphere, just lovely. It's lute music, folks. I mean, it's people playing lutes.
Mm-hmm.
What can I say? And just a wonderful singer, and it's very reflective, very meditative. Shirley Rumsey went on to join a group called Kit Hara, which also was another great lutenist, and some other people doing some great stuff. But this is like the kind of thing that you would just put on if you're just in a reverie and you just want to, you know, just completely chill.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I might have some lute music in my collection. I don't know if I have.
Everybody should.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Oh, man, I got a lot of flute music, I'll tell you.
Okay.
That. But I did not pick a flute-oriented album. My next one is some more... pop goodness, Prince, Sign of the Times.
Oh, yeah.
First off, Prince is an artist that I thought, I can't live without some Prince.
I
need some Prince in my desert life here. But Sign of the Times, I think some could argue that's a pinnacle Prince album or one of the greatest records he made. maybe not as commercially successful as Purple Rain or even 1999, but it's in that era, and it's a double album. It's more sprawling than
lots of goodness there.
Lots of goodness, but particularly if you're looking at the double LP and the four sides, side three, for close to two decades, I have referred to as one of the greatest album sides. The four songs on that album just work perfectly to me, and so I think for that reason alone, I would be content to have that one Prince record along for the ride. And
there you go. I would have picked Controversy, but that's me.
Hey, there's no controversy from me as far as what Prince album you would pick.
Well, the next one I picked was a double album, this record as well, is Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life.
Yep.
First of all, you got to have some Stevie. I mean, just, you know, so much goodness. And this is part of that four-album trilogy, or not trilogy. That wouldn't be a trilogy. That would be a quadrigy or something. I don't think that's a real word. But Music of My Mind, Talking Book, Inner Villain, Inner Visions, fulfilling his first finale. And this is a point in Stevie's career where he had almost decided to retire from music.
Wow.
But he came back with this record, and oh boy, are we glad that he did.
So prior to endeavoring this iconic double album, he considered perhaps not doing it anymore.
Yeah, he was going to move to Africa and just chill, I guess.
Yeah.
There, but he got a new contract. They paid him a boatload of money for the 70s, and he came back with this, and it was one of his biggest records. It was a double LP that included a four-song bonus EP.
Yeah, I was going to say, does your copy come with the 45 inside?
No, it didn't. Well, I have a CD, so what can I say?
Oh, yeah.
And also won Album of the Year, the 19th Annual Grammy Awards.
Wow.
We won't hold that against him.
No, not being that it's Stevie Wonder.
No. We allow him to win Grammys.
If a Grammy's going to go to somebody, yeah.
The other people who win Grammys are posers, but not Stevie.
I didn't put any Stevie in my mix. I left home without it accidentally. But that's another artist. It's one of the earliest in my memory of my mother listening to certain artists a lot. And she probably liked stuff a little bit earlier than that, kind of around the My Sharia Moore, that period.
What's not to love?
No. And that is a massive, Songs in the Key of Life is a massive album. That's a lot to bite off, really. The density, the depth of what he's expressing on there. That's a heavyweight record.
Yeah.
So, that's a great one. Well, I picked another soulful artist. Next, Otis Redding.
Yeah.
The immortal Otis Redding.
Indeed.
Which I think is a fitting title, being that it was released posthumously. But to my understanding, it was not a thrown together hodgepodge of material to release post-death. I believe it was a record he was working on.
Mm-hmm.
But it did not get released till after he was gone. I discovered it about 15 years ago. I already loved Otis Redding, but I had never come across that particular album. It has some well-known tracks on it. Hard to Handle's one of the bigger ones.
Is this the one that has Dock of the Bay?
No.
Oh, okay.
It's got...
That was a single, right? That wasn't... Was that...
There is an Otis album called Dock of the Bay.
Okay.
It's got the Happy Song, if you know that one, Fa Fa Fa.
Yeah, yeah.
The Happy Song.
I'm more familiar with the live version of that. Was that the studio version of that?
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
Yeah. And then just this really kind of reflective, wistful song called I've Got Dreams to Remember. Mm. Anyway, just there's something about this album, and the production feels like it's not overdone. It's very kind of straightforward, but just captures his voice. And, you know, we talked about it. We did an episode on soul music. So
yes.
Otis Redding, to me, is
The consummate soul man.
The consummate soul singer.
Yeah.
Burned hot. Didn't last very long.
Yeah. Through no fault of his own.
Through no fault of his own. It's kind of one of those tragic.
Yeah, it's still a tragedy that kind of rings down.
Yeah.
Through the ages.
So anyway, I had to pick an Otis record, and yeah, that's the one.
Okay, can't quibble with that. All right, made it to number 10, and you'll notice that I did a little switcheroo here on this one, because I originally had a record by Blue Oyster Cult called On Your Feet or On Your Knees.
Yeah.
And I just decided I put that on there not because it would be good on a desert island, but because it's just one of my favorite records of all time. But so what I did end up with, another double record from another hard rock band, Deep Purple's Made in Japan, which we've talked about on the show before. And I may have mentioned that this is when I need to clean the house and yeah, I really need to kick ass, that I put this record on and I turn it up really loud, and I can really get a lot of housework done in a very short period of time.
I love that. Fueled by the live Ian Gillan and Company.
Yeah.
Well, it's really Ritchie Blackmore and Company, but...
I like what you said first, actually.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that record, it, it's about the whole band, but
yeah,
the fact that Ian Gillan is so potent and powerful, I don't know if they did anything in the studio post-recording to clean it up. I've seen some live footage from that era, though. And Ian Gillan
delivered. The dude has the pipes.
Yeah, he really delivered, and it just carries you away. I mean, I think you'd probably agree the standout track is Child in Time.
Yeah, which... for me, it feels a little bit like the prototypical Spinal Tap track, you know? They have the little, you know, the little Stonehenge, you know, on the stage. But I'm not taking anything away from it because I love the song.
Yeah.
And
it's melodramatic song.
I think
I would say that's fair. It's melodramatic.
Yeah. And we were also talking about things, I don't know if we were talking about this before we started recording, but we were talking about things get overplayed. We were talking about that with the Doors, I think, maybe. But, of course, the live version of Smoke on the Water was something. The first song that I can really remember just being played to death.
Yeah.
Much so that if I'm within reach, I will skip that track.
It got played a lot. And back 70s, 80s, anybody that was starting to play hard rock guitar.
Guilty.
You know.
Guilty as charged.
I probably heard lots of people playing that riff, or you played that riff a lot, you know. But that's okay.
Every music store you would go into was either that or Stairway to Heaven.
Yeah. That main riff from Smoke on the Water is pretty easy to play, but it's effective. And that's why that song was so big.
Yeah.
But anyhow, that's a song they had to play, of course.
Name checks Frank Zappa.
Yeah.
But, I mean, things like Highway Star.
Oh, yeah. Highway Star, is Space Truckin' on there, too?
And on they released, an expanded version that had more material from that, and the song Black Knight.
Oh, man.
Just absolutely slays.
I haven't listened to that edition.
Yeah. Great, great, great stuff.
Maybe I'll bundle two together.
Okay. It's a twofer.
Because I have to mention Kate Bush. I love Kate Bush so much.
Me too.
That I don't think if I had the ability to choose before getting stranded on this desert island, I would have to pick Kate Bush. I picked her debut record. Even though she develops much more along the way, there's something, there's such a spark about that album. She was 17 or 18 when she produced that material. And I honestly like that record the most out of her entire catalog. The material, the energy, just adore that record. So if I should be so lucky, I would have that in the mix. But the biggest one that I've been talking about for a long time, Metallica, Ride the Lightning.
Okay.
The second Metallica record. Again, is it one of the greatest records of all time?
I have a confession to make. I do not own a Metallica record. And it's not that I don't think they're great or that I don't appreciate what they are doing. I just somehow managed to never buy a Metallica record. I don't know why. I don't know why that is.
I mean, you had been around for a little while before they came along. You knew some stuff before Metallica came, you know. Deep Purple, in fact.
There you go.
You would probably not have Metallica without Deep Purple.
Or Blue Oyster Cult.
Blue Oyster Cult, any of that.
Who they name check as one of their favorite bands.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, originally Metallica was very derivative of all those bands.
Yeah.
This, I would say, is their kind of break away from that, however, because their debut record, Kill 'Em All, is very derivative of Motorhead and some of the bands that were referred to as the new wave of British heavy metal, Judas Priest, Motorhead. So I think this is where they really sound truly like themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But it just hit me at some point years ago that, like, I just love this record so much. It means so much to me. It was a formative record. I think I started listening to it when I was 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It's
you got to have it.
Metallica fan who had their heart broken by Metallica at some point when I felt they kind of lost these qualities that made them important to me. That's probably partly why I hang on to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could listen to it over and over again.
Well, the only remotely Metallica thing I have is Apocalyptica, which is the cello band doing Metallica covers, which I absolutely love.
That was a neat thing. That was an interesting thing when that came out. Kind of turned that on its head, and some people went, whoa, you could look at Metallica in a different way. Well, if we had to swap our 10 Desert Island albums, would we be okay?
I think
maybe your list, perhaps more so than mine, would be a learning experience. There'd be some on there that would probably trip me up.
Could be. Oh, and you know, I finally get my Metallica record. It'd be a hard way to get it, but it would, you know.
Yeah. If the two of us were stranded together,
we would have 20 records. We would have something.
There's a plane that was headed to a record convention that went down.
That's right.
So we were actually saved by, you know, there was lots of records. But anyway, yeah, it's a fun thought experiment. We didn't get to the part where I was going to talk about the resentment of trying to narrow it down.
It is very hard to pick 10 of anything. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there.
Yeah.
Just want to say thanks for listening and or watching Low Pass Filter.
We really appreciate it. And again, comments, suggestions.
I guess I still have not been by the mailbox. I'm sure it's stuffed full of stuff. We'll have to next month for sure. But anyway, just want to thank you for being here, as always.
Well, thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, and thank you all for listening and or watching to Low Pass Filter, and we'll see you again next time. Thanks for watching Low Pass Filter. contact the hosts at lowpassfilter2020@gmail.com. Be sure to like and subscribe and hit the notification bell to be notified about future shows.